This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Welcome to another power-packed Radio EcoShock show. I'm Alex Smith. My guests are George Karunas, host of the TV show Angry Planet, and the solar-powered international musician known as Tortuga Blanco. But first, we'll talk with a high-powered international lawyer who switched from taking multinational companies into China to creating new alternatives for local economies in Asia and Africa. Radio EcoShock has remarkable guests. Our next is no exception. He was a lawyer advising China to bring big-name multinational companies into that Asian economy. Now he's writing about anti-globalization, localizing economies, and the coming collapse of the Western banking model. His latest book is Fusion Economics, How Pragmatism is Changing the World. Who is Lawrence J. Brom? Let's find out. Lawrence Brom, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you, Alex. It's a pleasure to be on your show.
It's hard to understand your activism, Lawrence, without a quick run-through of where you came from. Tell us about your work in China in the 1990s.
Well, my work in China was actually on the other side of the table. I was first a lawyer and economist advising multinational corporations on their entry in China, because that's what I thought was, you know, a way to transform China from planning to market. But later, working actually as an advisor to the government on that transition and realizing very clearly that the approach would not be shock therapy, IMF, World Bank. These cookie-cutter models were not working for China. So I was very actively a participant in the advisory group of then-Premier Zhu Rongji on state-owned enterprise reform and financial reform. But later, after he stepped down, I decided to go down to the grassroots and set up social enterprises, really at the community level, in the old section of Beijing, and then onwards into Tibet, where we built a very expansive social enterprise built on the principles of heritage restoration, community empowerment, as well as reaching out to communities, nomadic communities, with medical care and education.
You would be making big money. Why did you leave the legal world?
I'd had enough, and I had also an ethical problem with what I saw as the imposition of systems that don't work or that in many ways ultimately lead to the disenfranchisement of people. And so what I really felt was needed was not just top-down approaches and approaches of globalization, but rather diversified localization. Also, I realized that you can't think of economics simply as a material growth measurement or matrix. You have to think of it as involving psychology of people, and that has to do with community, it has to do with spirituality, it has to do with topography, geography, all the things that affect people and make people human. And just accumulating or consuming conspicuously, as the classical economists advise, is not a formula for a healthy economy. At some point, you just have to face yourself in the mirror and say, ethically, what can I stand for and what can I live with?
And you founded something called the Himalayan Consensus. Please tell us what that is.
Well, the Himalayan Consensus evolved naturally from my work with social enterprise in Tibet. We realized that the approach of the grassroots, the approach of community empowerment, really was something that was working. And we wanted to see what else was out there, who was doing what in the region. And to my surprise, traveling all across South Asia, I found out a lot of people, a lot of groups are all engaging in different ways to empower their community, get off the grid, come up with decentralized renewable energy, microfinancing solutions for community empowerment. And I realized not only are we not the only ones out there, but if you connect the dots between all of these, what they call alternative economic models, we have a new mainstream. And bringing on board people like Mohamed Yunus, who were pioneering then microfinance, or the Bhutanese government, that was calling for gross national happiness rather than gross national product as a measure of economic health. We really fused these ideas together. The Himalayan consensus emerged as three core principles: protecting ethnic identity or local identity, includes everything involving heritage, culture, community, through the second principle, which is a business, which then calls for changes in the nature of our global finance, because capital is not getting to people. It's being taken away from people. It's going to capital markets, and in many ways disenfranchising communities. So to reverse that process. And the third pillar is the protection of the environment, and making that not only a priority of all business decisions, but actually seeing that as an opportunity for the next mega growth trend in business, that is the technology and innovation required to create renewable and efficient energy systems, water and catchment recycling systems to protect our planet and make it available for future generations.
And Lawrence, you've written about the move away from the U.S. dollar as the world reserve currency. If I'm just a simple American working in California or Iowa, what does it matter to me whether the dollar is the reserve currency or not?
Well, it comes down to the simple question that if the dollar is the reserve currency of the world, as was set up in the Bretton Woods system after World War II, the Fed can print as many dollars as it wants without ever having to worry about devaluation or any of the effects of that would happen in any other country. And so simply, for instance, the quantitative easing, which has then allowed the federal government to print trillions of dollars on the basis of buying back its own debt, has created a financial bubble or incubating the next major financial crisis. So if another country is China or a collection of countries, for instance, the BRICS through the BRICS Development Bank, issue a second reserve currency that is broadly accepted, particularly in the developing world, with those parts of the world which are being pushed off of the grid consistently, like Russia, you will then see a challenge to dollar supremacy with another option for a reserve currency. That would unfortunately allow other countries to print as much money as they want, but it would limit the power of the US dollar and its influence. And that, of course, it affects somebody in California because it affects their expectations. It affects the power of the federal government. It affects the power of it to simply print money and come up with this type of inflated artificial financial policy that has fueled our capital markets and is continuing to make the 1% richer and disempower more people in the country.
So in 1996, you wrote a book predicting China would become number one, the world's largest economy. Some people at that time thought it was a bit nutty. Has it happened?
Well, in 1996, I wrote a book called China is Number One, playing with the name that Ezra Vogel, who once wrote Japan is Number One, had predicted the rise of Japan. And really, I wasn't panda-hugging. I wasn't praising China. I was just on the inside working with the policymakers on a daily basis. I knew the trajectory of what they were doing and where it would go. And I said, look at these facts. This is where this economy is headed, and it will become one day the number one economy in the world. And according this past year to statements of the IMF, it is. And as the number one economy, China has now a whole different position. So people who were then bashing me, saying I was a panda hugger at the time, can look that China's number one was a prophecy. I mean, it's basically looking at the tea leaves, but seeing clearly what will happen based on facts of the time. Hmm. I'll add that I have similarly predicted the rise of a second reserve currency. In 2009, I was speaking at the Center for Strategic International Studies in Washington, and there were actually people there who did not want to allow me to take the stage and speak because of comments I had written in their newsletter about China and India wanting to get out of the IMF, or not out of the IMF, to create their own alternative to the IMF and World Bank, because they were not able to get enough influence in these institutions despite their financial might and economic growth. And because of their frustration in not having that influence, they would set up an alternative financial system with an alternative to the IMF and World Bank, which we now see with the BRICS Development Bank and the Asia Infrastructure Investment Bank. And moreover, that the end game of this would be a new reserve currency. And at that time, people were really, really angry with me. But we've already now seen the emergence of these new financial institutions, a South-South financial architecture being put into place as an alternative to the Bretton Woods institutions. And I sincerely believe that the next reserve currency is just around the corner.
China's supergrowth has come at tremendous cost, though, Lawrence. You told the BBC that about 70% of the underground water in China is undrinkable, and about 60% of all surface water is too toxic for human contact, and we can't live without water. Can China restore its balance with nature?
This has been the focus of my work the past 2 years. I have been an advisor to China's Ministry of Environmental Protection, and I've actually argued quite vociferously against what I call the blind growth model. And we need to look at why that model exists. All your Bloomberg, CNBC, everybody is guessing, is China's growth 8%, 7.5%, 7%, what will it be? And we have to understand that the original 8% growth target was set in 1998 by Zhu Rongji to deal with a very specific issue at that time, and that was the transition of overemployed labor from the state-owned enterprises into the private sector as they reformed those enterprises into corporations. And that number, 8%, given the circumstances at the time, was fixed as a formula. However, following Zhu Rongji's retirement, the following premier, Wen Jiabao, focused on high growth, and everything was about surpassing 8%. This was done really through a $3 trillion stimulus package on fixed asset investment. Officials were being promoted on the basis of growth, which really meant redundant projects. And this fueled a lot of hypergrowth in China. Inflation made actually the labor force compatible with other parts of the world, driving manufacturing out of China, and in turn polluting the river systems, the agricultural systems, depleting the forest, and opening a plethora of mining licenses. And I've been very openly critical about this and calling for a rethink of the GDP model, which I do believe that rethink is taking place right now. There are signs of that. For instance, Zhejiang province announced about 2 months ago that they would have local officials promoted only on the basis of clean air and healthcare systems, not on the basis of GDP. And the leadership is starting to mince their words with statements like elasticity of growth rather than fixing to growth numbers. And so I think that this is a sign of a change of thinking at the top. China is facing an impending water crisis. It is also facing a potential food crisis. They have polluted most of their agricultural systems. This is one reason why they're investing very heavily in Africa and Patagonia and South America to be able to acquire food security. But they also realize they need to change their own environmental damage. Another aspect of the advice that my team has been giving is that if they're going to continue with fixed asset investment growth, fine. But that fixed asset investment growth needs to be in regridding the system, getting away from fossil fuels, particularly coal, which accounts for 70% of all China's energy needs. And signs of this shift are taking place. They've already announced that they will be putting in 20 million electric car filling stations, meaning electricity filling stations, by the year 2020. And using fiscal and credit policies, are giving $9,000 rebates to people if they buy electric cars. This is a sign of this shift taking place. But there's a heck of a lot of work that's going to have to be done.
As there is in all countries. Now, you are tuned to the Radio EcoShock Show. I'm Alex Smith with my guest, Lawrence J. Brom, author of Fusion Economics, How Pragmatism is Changing the World. As I heard it, Lawrence, you attended the 2011 climate conference in Durban, South Africa, and left in disgust to join the protesters outside. What did you see there?
Well, what influenced me most was not just the protests, because nobody inside could hear with all the Darth Vader security, you know, separating the protesters from the heads of state and delegates inside. What impressed me was actually a group of African students at KwaZulu University who were coming up with their alternative COP meeting. And that meeting, they carefully mapped out the procedures and steps that would be required to create 1 million climate change jobs. Using the number of unemployed, official unemployed in South Africa, 1 million people, they were saying we're going to create 1 million jobs through the process of transitioning fossil fuel energy plants to renewable systems, going from coal-fired to solar, which certainly South Africa has a lot of, wind, other sources. And they had this thing so carefully planned out, step by step. I thought it was an incredible policy brief. And I actually took it back to China. And it was the inspiration from these African students that was behind the climate change work that I did for the next 2 years of, again, looking at fiscal and credit policy together with fixed asset investments of the state to transition grids from fossil fuels to renewables, and to add the energy-saving insulation and water recycling systems that are needed to be able to create a sustainable planet, but also to create jobs, employment, and re-empower people. And want to know something? That's what we need to be doing back in the United States. The $3 trillion of quantitative easing have gone into banks, which have just played with the derivatives market. It is basically put on an intravenous, you know, the dead animal of the financial market after 2008 resuscitated it and created inflation in Asia as these banks and investors have, institutional investors have speculated on commodities and minerals and growth there. None of it went into our infrastructure and none of it went into communities. And it should have gone into infrastructure that's renewable and efficient and created real jobs for real people while bringing down energy costs. And that would have been a sensible and rational use of the $3 trillion, which is now actually incubating the next financial crisis just around the corner.
We probably could have gotten the United States off of fossil fuels for $3 trillion.
You not only could have done that, but you would have created real employment. Even with the so-called improved labor figures now, I'm sorry, I'm out in San Francisco. You've got more people begging on the streets there, homeless, than you do in New Delhi. And that's not a joke. I had been in New Delhi only a few weeks before visiting San Francisco, and I was really shocked. And all of that money is trading commodities, also the so-called tech stocks. We have an economy now that's driven by four stocks, Twitter, Google, Facebook, and Apple. Apple's the only one that actually produces anything. And it's really all about a future option in a commodity. It's a soybean. And, you know, nobody ever cooked the soybean at the end of the day in a future commodity trade. And we really need to be putting the capital market money into renovation of technology for the environment, for climate change, and to create real jobs, not just for a few tech kids, but jobs that will be reaching the middle class and blue-collar workers, because all of the regridding that's needed in our system is necessary not only for clean energy, but for cost-efficient energy, and more so to upgrade our infrastructure, which right now is way, way behind Asia.
That's sad to hear. Now, you mentioned China made major investments in Africa, including buying farmland there. You've been in Africa, and you created something there called the African Consensus. Tell us about that, please.
Well, the African Consensus builds on the principles of the Himalayan Consensus about community empowerment through local business and finance, protecting the environment. But it goes beyond that, because in Africa, civil society has really taken over and is leading the effort at addressing their own community issues. That's partly because of the dysfunctionality of government, not too different from our own system, and the failure of aid programs, which are basically political and impose conditions that may not be relevant for these countries. And so with the African consensus, we're really trying to build on the principles of the Himalayan consensus, but the African activists have added a few more principles. For instance, food and water is a human right. Also in the African consensus declaration, which was adopted by the African Commission on Human and People's Rights in Gambia in April 2011 at their NGO forum, the view was taken that conflict and even terrorism is not caused by religion, as is popular in many mainstream Western media, but rather it's caused by the disempowerment of people economically and the marginalization of their identity. And with these two issues are addressed, it will severely reduce the amount of conflict and terror.
Now, you've been an international trade and investment lawyer, and you've also, as we've just heard, created a lot of alternatives to centralized power. What is your vision in the book on fusion economics?
Well, the vision of fusion economics is if we take the so-called alternative approaches to economics around the world and we connect the dots, we'll realize that we already have a new mainstream. That mainstream is looking at business differently. It's looking at community empowerment. It's looking at a more holistic way of evolving our planet. It's looking at future generations rather than just aggrandizement or luxury for the current generation. And it is involving solutions that are not coming from think tanks, not coming from ivory tower university professors who have not ever dealt with business or community challenge in their life. It's coming from the communities. It's coming from people who worked out the solutions themselves. And it's really saying, look at these solutions, recognize them as innovation, look at the environmentalists, tree huggers, but as your R&D for the future, and those coming up with the local solutions, whether it's community finance or whether that is social enterprise or whether it's renewable efficient energy systems at the community level, as your innovators, and get capital to them and let them empower themselves. It's looking at not at the monolithic globalization, it's looking at diversified localization. It's rejecting the idea of Thomas Friedman that the world is flat and everybody should be Walmart, and saying, no, the world is quite round, it's quite diverse, it's quite complex, and within that complexity, we should rejoice in its diversity, and we should allow those systems that are diverse by nature to thrive, rather than try to boil them down into one flat melting pot and put everything in a box on a shelf where it's cheap for a multinational corporation to distribute it and basically leave people without identity or without self.
Lawrence Brum, what are you working on these days and who are the people you're talking most with?
Right now, with the organizations, the Himalayan Consensus, the African Consensus, as well as the New Earth Institute, I'm working as an economic advisor, primarily on climate change issues. The key focus right now, for instance, this morning I was working on a draft bilateral agreement between the European Union and China on issues of climate change. That agreement will be discussed and most likely signed in Brussels this summer to go to Paris. I'm also working, advising the Bhutanese government on waste treatment issues, water issues, and we're convening the Himalayan Consensus process this autumn in the September 9th and 10th in Kathmandu, which is really looking to feature those young, innovative, social, enterprise, and environmental economic pioneers in the region and bring business and financial leaders to the table to look at how those breakthroughs of innovation can be scaled. Also inviting government to come and listen. Our view is government steal this idea. And in addition, in the U.S. side, I've joined a group with Transition Towns of America and permaculture leaders there to try and present to Jerry Brown a proposal on California's water crisis. Again, trying to work from the community level and roll out the permaculture solution and scale it, and demonstrate how permaculture run at the community level can save vast amounts of water and increase food production. And for a state with a lot of people who don't have food, that's pretty necessary.
We've been talking with a whirlwind named Lawrence J. Brom, and you can find out more on Lawrence's YouTube channel. His most thought-provoking new book is Fusion Economics, How Pragmatism is Changing the World. Look for that. Find more links in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.info. Lawrence, thank you for your tireless work and for talking with us today.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure.
I'm Alex Smith, reporting for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. Coming up, green TV and solar-powered music. This is Radio EcoShock. There's so much interest in extreme weather. You know, every newscast seems to feature a storm, and with climate disruption, there will be plenty more to see. That's good news for our next guest, George Karunas. He travels the world looking for adventure and downright dangerous weather for his television series, Angry Planet. There's a new batch of shows running right now, so George, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Oh, thank you very much. Glad to be here.
You are all about great stories. I've seen some of them on TV. Tell us what's up in the new Angry Planet series.
Yeah, well, we're back for season four, which is just a delight to be involved in. And on this new season, we're really taking a closer look at the forces behind what's going on in the weather, mainly climate change. So it's not just going into a forest fire or checking out storms. It's sort of seeing how we're affecting the global climate and how our influence as a species is actually changing the world. So it's very exciting for me, and we get to travel all over the world, and you get to see some pretty amazing dramatic stuff as well.
What are some of the locations you'll visit?
Oh, the Brazilian Amazon, which was fantastic. We were in Adelaide, Australia for the biggest forest fire, or brush fire as they call them down there, down under, the biggest in 30 years. I revisited a volcano in Vanuatu that I descended down into back in September. I went back there with a scientist, and we measured all kinds of greenhouse gases and seeing how volcanoes are affecting the atmosphere, just all kinds of things. Cape Verde Islands, to the island of Tuvalu, which is the entire nation, is actually at threat due to rising sea levels. And it may actually become the first nation, or one of the first nations, to actually have climate change refugees. And the island itself, or the island nation, is in threat of actually physically disappearing.
You know, that's something I noticed in your Angry Planet Australia series. I was pleased to find you're not in that dwindling group of meteorologists or weather watchers who deny climate change. And I'm really thrilled that this is going to come out in your new series.
Well, you know, really, it comes down to whether you understand science or not. It is absolutely unequivocally confirmed by so many climatologists that we know what's going on. It's not a matter of, we're so far beyond the point of, is this happening? We really, really need to be focusing on what do we do about this. I'm afraid that we're going to leave a legacy for future generations that they're not going to be able to deal with. We need to nip this in the bud as much as we can. And there are so many instances that I've seen that we're on the edge of a tipping point that I certainly am hopeful, but certainly worried that we may not be able to dig ourselves out of.
Well, let's back this up a bit. How did you, George, get started as a storm chaser?
Yeah, it's such a weird career path. Being actually says adventurer and storm chaser on my business card, which I think is just so surreal. As a kid, I was always interested in science and nature and the earth. And just, I wanted to be a marine biologist and travel the world and study it. And as I grew older, I sort of got away from that. But then I revisited it once I was sort of a bit older and got interested in photography and travel again. And basically, I chased my first storm back in 1998. I was in Oklahoma. I had teamed up with some experienced storm chasers who knew what they were doing and taught me the ropes. And I witnessed my very first tornado. And it wasn't very photogenic. It was just this dusty bowl but it came right for us. And we had to turn around and get out of the way and across the road right where we had been parked. And that sense of being so small next to something so big, these storms that produce tornadoes could be twice the height of Mount Everest and focusing all their attention on that one spot. And the adrenaline rush that came with that, I totally became hooked, and I've been chasing tornadoes ever since, and I've been in 18 hurricanes, volcanoes all over the world, any type of extreme force of nature, I've probably witnessed it, and just loving every minute of it.
We had one previous extreme weather guest, that was Jeff Masters of the Weather Underground. He used to ride government planes literally into the eye of the hurricane. Have you tried that yet?
Yes, I have. I know, of course I know who Jeff Masters is, and yes, I have. I've flown with the United States Air Force Reserves from Biloxi, Mississippi, and flew in one of their CF-130 Hurricane Hunter planes into the eye of Hurricane Ike, just off the coast of Cuba as it was making its way into the Gulf of Mexico. And let me tell you, that was quite the experience. It's amazing how they can pilot these planes into a hurricane. They're so tall that you can't fly over them unless you're in the International Space Station. But penetrating through the side, it's a very turbulent ride. And once you're in the middle, of course, it's very, very calm, and you can see all the way down to the ocean. It was quite the experience. And 2 days after that, I was able to re-encounter the hurricane again, this time on the ground on the island of Galveston when it made its final landfall there. So I was able to intercept Hurricane Ike twice.
And now, according to scientists that I have interviewed on the show, including some of the top atmospheric experts in the world, there's at least 4% more water in the atmosphere than there was in 1970. And when we add in tons of pollution, that's the recipe for extreme precipitation events. I guess you've covered some extreme rainfalls.
Oh, absolutely. Of course, that incoming solar radiation from the sun is heating up the oceans, and there they cover most of the Earth, 71% of it, of course, and most of the energy is absorbed by those dark ocean surfaces, which in turn creates more evaporation, which puts more of that energy into the atmosphere. And just for an example, and you'll see this in the new series, the day that we landed in Funafuti on the island nation of Tuvalu, they had a record rainfall of 354, somewhere in there, in that range, millimeters of rain in 24 hours. The entire island was half underwater, basically.
Wow. And if it's cold enough, it's extreme snow, like the record 8 feet plus that Boston got this past winter. Did Boston make your new Angry Planet series, I'm wondering?
It didn't, actually. We got a lot of snow here in the east. I was in Buffalo when they had their record, or just crippling snowfall back earlier in the winter. And, of course, Boston has been hammered. And even here in Toronto, where I am, we had a very harsh winter. But I spent a fair amount of my winter traveling, filming in the South Pacific in places like Australia and Vanuatu and Fiji. So I can't say that I suffered a whole lot in terms of the winter here in North America. I wish I had a machine that I could clone myself and be in more than one place at a time. But technology's not quite there yet. I'm kind of hoping that some mad scientist is working on that right now.
Well, we'll get it from Microsoft, no doubt. You travel the world to experience volcanoes erupting. In fact, you were married beside one. How was that for a wedding party?
It wasn't actually beside. It was directly on top at the summit. There's a volcano in the South Pacific called Yasser. And back in 2006, my fiancée, Michelle, and I climbed the side of the volcano. I had my tuxedo on. She had her wedding dress. And the locals were performing the ceremony wearing grass skirts, face paint, feathers in their hair, and they blew the conch shell to announce the arrival of the bride as we hiked up the side of this exploding volcano that erupts every 5 minutes for the past 800 years. And it was just such an amazing experience. All of that uncertainty and just chaos going on with the volcano. You didn't know what was going to happen next. It was actually quite the metaphor for marriage itself and a really amazing experience.
Well, again, business should be good for you. Scientific papers predict there will be more seismic activity as water from these big glaciers at the poles create rising seas. All that extra water weight will press on every weakness in the Earth's crust. It's still early days, but there should be some rocking and rolling. Are you going to continue filming volcanoes?
Oh, yes, absolutely. They're one of my passions. I love them dearly. And each one is different, and they act differently. They behave differently. And I've been fortunate enough to visit volcanoes from New Zealand to Iceland, Indonesia, Central America, the Caribbean, even Antarctica. And they all behave differently. And it's really interesting going to a place like Hawaii and watching where the lava is pouring into the ocean, creating the newest land on Earth. The big island of Hawaii is still expanding and getting bigger and adding more real estate. It's the force that creates the land masses here on Earth. And it's just such a fascinating process to witness that. Now, of course, all of these natural forces become natural disasters when they affect human populations. And I never want to see a tornado hit a town or a hurricane make landfall in a populated area or have a volcano pyroclastic flow go into a village. But these things happen, and my being there to document them will certainly not make any difference as to whether it happens or not. But being able to show the world what is going on is what I hope to accomplish by going to these places, and volcanoes certainly is a large part of that.
Now, from your experiences, I wonder if you can offer any tips of what our listeners should do if they find themselves threatened by extreme weather. Do you have safety tips of do's and don'ts?
Oh, well, absolutely. Of course, it depends on what kind of severe weather you're encountering. Always heed the warnings that you hear from Environment Canada or the National Weather Service or the Bureau of Meteorology, depending upon what country you're in. They know what they're doing. If there's a tornado warning for your town, get to the basement. Don't run outside with your phone and try and videotape it. I can't recommend that. I've got 17 years of experience chasing these things, so I know what to look for, but you certainly may not. It's better to, you know, just get to the basement and live to see another day. When it comes to something like a hurricane, heed the evacuation warnings. These storms are so dangerous. During Hurricane Katrina, I was in Gulfport, Mississippi. The storm surge raised the ocean levels 28 feet above normal, and I was a half mile inland and had water still up to my waist, and that's what kills most people in a hurricane. It's not the wind. It's not flying debris. It's drowning from the storm surge. So if you don't really fully understand the force that you're dealing with, it's best to just run away. Mother Nature is so big and so powerful compared to us puny humans, and I've witnessed it so many times. It's sometimes best to just split, get out of there, de-ass the area, get as far away as you can.
Has there been a time or two when you went outside the frame of being a TV host and got genuinely worried you might have gone too far this time? What are the most dangerous moments for George Karunas?
Yeah, that has absolutely happened. It's interesting because I love doing these things regardless of the TV show. The TV show came about because I was already doing these things. And so my passion for experiencing nature up close has just inherently put me in a few dangerous situations. There were times when I, for example, during Hurricane Dean in Jamaica, I was almost washed away by storm surge. I got out just with seconds to spare. On that same storm chase, I got hit by a car. The next day, I was in downtown Montego Bay, Jamaica. The power was out because of the hurricane. Someone had stolen my producer's wallet and was running away with it. I chased after him and ended up getting hit by a car. I flipped up onto the hood, over the windshield, over the hood, landed on the ground behind the car, jumped up and kept chasing after the guy. He got away, but I had so much adrenaline pumping through my veins that I didn't even stop to see if I had a broken leg. I'm very, very fortunate I didn't get injured. There was another encounter in Kenya where I was in a cave, in this bat-filled cave, and the cave is known for having exposed people to Marburg hemorrhagic fever, which is the first cousin of the Ebola virus. And I had one of these bats bite through my glove and into my thumb. I didn't know if I had a week left to live, if my internal organs were going to turn into chunky salsa. So, yeah, sometimes it's not necessarily the things you expect to be dangerous that become dangerous, and that's sort of part of the curveball that gets thrown at you when you do these sort of extreme expeditions and things like that.
Yes. Now, who broadcasts the TV show Angry Planet?
It's on Pivot Television in the U.S.
And is there a way to see past episodes if we happen to miss them?
I'm not sure if Pivot is going to have them on their website right now. I do know that you can get a sneak peek right now. If you go on to Pivot's website and just take a look, go to pivot.tv and just look for Angry Planet, and they've got the first episode online right now for a sneak preview, and you can see that anywhere in the world.
I'll check it out. Are you part of a community of extreme weather watchers around the world?
Oh, absolutely. I'm a trained Skywarn spotter in the U.S., a Canwarn spotter in Canada, and I keep track and tabs on the weather all around the world. I've got friends who are storm chasers, weather watchers, meteorologists all over the world in so many different countries. Each morning when I wake up, I log onto my computer, and instead of checking the news, I go and I check and see what's going on, so I know exactly where there's a threat for tornadoes, where has there been the most recent earthquakes, what's going on in the tropics, are there any hurricanes brewing anywhere in the world, things like that.
And what are some of those places on the Internet you would recommend to get the intelligence on upcoming weather hotspots?
Oh, well, if you want to know what's going on in the U.S. in terms of severe weather, go to the Storm Prediction Center's website. They're the government agency that deals with all of the tornado watches and things like that. In Canada, the Environment Canada website has a really good warning system on there, so you can really see what's going on. In terms of the tropics, globally, one of my favorite sites is a site called tropicalstormrisk.com. And there you can see any hurricane, cyclone, or typhoon that's threatening anywhere on Earth. It's a really great resource.
Can you tell us where you will be heading next, or is that secret until the next series comes out?
Well, I just got back from filming two new episodes that are going to air later in the year. I can't really say where they are, but one of them was very, very cold, and the other one was very, very hot. And coming up in 3 weeks, I actually depart on my annual tornado chase. I work with a tornado chasing tour company, Cloud9 Tours, and we take people from all over the world to go and chase tornadoes. I've been doing that for about 12 years now. We get people from Australia and England, all across the U.S. They come to Oklahoma City. We pick them up at the airport and live like nomads for 2 weeks at a time, just doing our weather forecast in the morning, going into position, and then hopefully a tornado will form or a large supercell thunderstorm, and we track it till late at night, find a place to stay, and then do it all over again. It's really a fun experience, and I get to see some little pockets of the United States that most people will never get to see.
We've been speaking with Canadian-born adventurer, world traveler, storm chaser, and broadcaster George Karunas. Find him at angryplanet.tv. I'll put some links in my show blog at ecoshock.info. George's newest Angry Planet series is live now on Pivot TV. George, thank you so much for joining us on Radio EcoShock.
Oh, thank you very much.
I'm Alex Smith reporting.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
Stars, a lot of them, but only when I'm far away, because it's like day and night in the city where we hide. I see stars, a lot of them, but only when I'm far away, because it's like day and night in the city where we hide. I see stars.
Oh yeah, a solar-powered music studio in the Caribbean, that sounds good, and it does sound good, as the artist known as Tortuga Blanco records some green music in a green way. And the person who does this is really Martin. Martin, where were you in the Caribbean?
I was living on a small island called Bonaire, which is known especially amongst scuba divers for its easy accessible coral reefs.
Yeah. And why did you build a solar-powered music-making studio there?
Well, there's this enormous amount of energy hitting the surface of the Earth day in, day out, and the sun rays from the sun, of course. And it's only logical to make use of it, is what I'm thinking. Also, there, it's a lot less polluting than making use of fossil fuels. And if you, as a global society, don't want to die of your own waste, you have to turn to renewable energy eventually. And also, it's really pretty cool to live on solar energy, and you know, the feeling of being independent. So I went looking for a house that was completely off the grid, found one, and set up my musical my music studio in it. So it's not just the music studio; it was the whole house that was powered by solar energy.
Right, it's a frame of mind to be independent of off the grid. I've done it, and I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, yeah, me too. It's very nice. I mean, there were quite a lot of power outages on the island, and I never had to worry about it. I always had power.
Yeah, we didn't even know that the power had gone out. We'd go into town, they'd say, "Oh, we lost power for 2 days." We'd go, "Oh, really?"
I had the same thing. Yeah, yeah, yeah. It was excellent. I was always kind of, you know, grinning to myself.
And tell us, what was your solar system made up of? You had panels, you had batteries. How did it work?
Yeah, it was basically a normal standard setup. A system. The system comprised of 18 photovoltaic panels up on the roof, together being 1,400 watts, and they turned the sunshine into electricity, which charged the batteries. Those were six-fold batteries in total. And a charge controller then makes sure that the deep cycle batteries, which they are, they're not normal car batteries, of course, are charged in the right way. And because these batteries were placed into parallel and then in series, it was a 12-fold system. The inverter turned it into a 110-fold 60 hertz to power up the whole house, including the solar studio. And I've got a YouTube series called Time for a Break, and the latest just released episode has an explanation about this all. I actually show it, my former studio and the solar system setup, which is really nice, I think.
I'll put a link to that in my blog so people can watch it. It's really nice to look at. And what kind of songs do you write?
It's kind of eclectic. It's several different genres melted together, usually pretty catchy and upbeat, if I say so myself. Some of the songs are about eco topics, and others are just plain funshine.
And are you playing and recording real instruments, or do you employ computer-driven virtual instruments?
I use mostly real instruments in my songs, like electric guitars, bass guitars, digital piano, vocals, of course. The drums are programmed, and I do use some software instruments as well. Of course, all the mixing and the mastering and the EQing, the delays, reverbs, or whatever you that you put on there post-recording, that all happens in the computer. I'd like to have as less hardware as possible, as that means less electricity use.
Yeah, you have to watch that with solar power. So now you've moved to France. Is that the end of solar-powered music from Tortuga Blanca?
No. I recently moved to Europe, indeed, but it will not be the end of my solar power music. Right now, I've still got quite a stash of songs and videos that I recorded in the Caribbean using only solar power, and that stuff I obviously am going to place on my website and on Facebook in the future. And the idea is that by the time I run out of solar-powered material, I have a new solar studio set up here in France.
Are you in the north of France or the south?
In the middle.
Okay. And is there enough sunlight there to generate good solar power?
Absolutely, absolutely. I think that most the most solar-powered country still is Germany, which is more to the north than France, with probably less sunshine, I imagine. And they have the most solar power systems, I guess, in the world. I'm not sure if that is per capita or, you know, if the, or if it's in total, but they do have a lot of solar power systems over there.
Yeah.
And here in France as well, I see it all over the place. I see it in cities, in small towns, here in the countryside where I live now. My neighbor, for example, he has both his house and his farm barn are covered with solar panels.
And France just issued a new decree saying all roofs for new construction either have to be living roofs, that means complete with soil and plants up there, or solar roofs. That's pretty amazing, isn't it?
Yeah, I read about that too, and that's, you know, that's the way to go. And actually, most people don't realize it, but there's an optimum temperature by which solar panels work the best. And in the Caribbean, there might be a lot of direct sunlight and you know, lots of hours of sunlight, or relatively lots of hours of sunlight, but it's probably too hot. Photovoltaic solar power panel production works most efficiently in colder temperatures. From what I understand, is but above 25 degrees Celsius, the efficiency decreases, and underneath 25 degrees Celsius, it increases up to a certain point, of course. So you would think that the Caribbean is more suitable for solar power, but actually other parts of the world with less sunshine and colder temperatures are better suited for solar energy.
I had no idea. You've just taught me something new. Why did you choose the name Tortuga Blanco?
Tortuga Blanco is a nickname I was given when I was conducting sea turtle research in the Caribbean. Tortuga Blanco literally means white turtle. And it's the name in the local language for green turtle. And, you know, it kind of stuck on me. So I figured, well, why not use it for my musician name?
And were you diving there as well yourself?
Of course, yes. It's beautiful to dive over there.
And I'll put a link to your spot on Bandcamp, the music distribution site. But can you suggest an easy way for people to Google you?
Yeah, if you just Google the name Tortuga Blanco, and I might, you know, just spell it, it's T-U-R-T-U-G-A, that's Tortuga, and then Blanco is B-L-A-N-K-U, Tortuga Blanco. Google will give you my website, tortugablanco.com, my SoundCloud page, my Bandcamp page, my Facebook page, YouTube page, etc., and I would really appreciate it if you listeners to EcoShock would check it out, listen to some of the songs, watch the series Time for a Break, read the 5Q interviews that I did with people like Vandana Shiva, the MASH actor Mike Farrell, The World Without Us author Alan Weisman, and so on. So feel free to send me a friend request on Facebook as well. I'd love to connect with, you know, listeners of a program like this.
Now I've got to find all that stuff and put links to it. I didn't know you talked to Alan Weisman. I recorded one of his speeches. It's interesting. He was on a tour, and he didn't want me to broadcast his whole speech because he still had like 100 cities to go to.
But
I still have that speech. I should dig it out. I did some excerpts, but I think now I could let the whole thing go. Very interesting guy.
That would be nice. I would really like to hear that. Absolutely.
Are there any questions you'd like to ask me?
Yes, I know that you are making music as well, which can be heard on the show. Are you planning on maybe also building a solar studio to power up your music?
That's in the works. It's going to take me a couple of years. We're moving to a place that does have the right roof orientation, and I have to see how much all that costs, and then we do plan to put solar up on there, partly because it's the right thing to do, but also because electricity costs here are going up like 15% a year or so. And it's come to the point where people are paying as much for their electricity. If they have electric heat here, they're paying as much for their electricity as they do for rent.
Well, it makes sense, of course, because the fossil fuel, you know, it's getting more and more expensive to extract it. And in a way, that is a good thing to happen, because then people will start to make the change, will start to turn to renewable energy instead of the fossil fuel. So it is kind of logical that it is happening, and it would be nice to see more people turning to renewable energy and solar energy or whatever. You know, you can use wind energy as well, of course.
I think people will do it when it becomes a bit painful to pay their regular utility bills. And that's a sad thing to say about us, that we have to experience some pain to make the change. But it's true, and it's true even for myself. It has to make sense economically at this point, because I don't have very much money.
Yeah, no, but I don't think that is necessarily a sad thing. I mean, the economies are profit-driven, and that's the way it is at the moment. So if that means that in such a way you can turn to renewable energy because it's more profitable, it's less expensive to do that, I don't see a problem with that. It's not really necessarily a sad thing to me. It's just, oh, okay, that works fine. Whenever people can make money, they're more inclined to do it. So, okay, that's good.
What I'd like to see, Martin, is some government no-interest loans for installing solar power, because what can happen is the rich say, well, I can afford the electricity no matter what it costs, so maybe I won't bother. But the poorer people who really need solar power can't afford to make that upfront investment. They can afford to pay over the months for it, but they can't do it right up front like that.
And that's one of the things that you can find in Europe more often. You can get some kind of subsidy to start building your own system, or usually it is you have to pay a company to start building your system, because if you do it yourself, you cannot get the subsidies. But at least they are there, they are in place. And especially in France, I know that that is something that was going on for a long time. And that's why, for example, my neighbor has so many solar panels up on his roof. Normally, you would not be able to pay, you know, that amount of solar panels at one go, a normal person. But because it was subsidized, he was able to do that. So I'm going to look into that as well to see what's the idea. You know, I only recently moved here, so I'm not yet clear on all the ins and outs. But that is something that more countries should do, indeed. Just get some kind of subsidy going to promote it even more.
Yeah, and especially for a country like India. Now, there you have people who can just barely make their electricity costs if they can get electricity. But there's still 200 million people don't have electricity in India. And solar panels are just the obvious answer for them, and I would just love to see a flood of them go in really cheaply with some institutional backing that you go ahead and make your payments and change that country over. We've been talking with Martin, who makes solar-powered music as Tortuga Blanco, as we've said. Check my blog at ecoshock.info for links to his songs and now to his interviews. Thank you so much, Martin, for joining us on Radio EcoShock.
Thank you for having me, and thanks to all the listeners of Radio EcoShock for listening to this.
Radio EcoShock.
Get all the links for this week's show and my Radio EcoShock blog, published every Wednesday, at ecoshock.info. Thanks for joining us this week. Stay tuned for more shocking news from planet Earth. I'm Alex Smith. Please, keep caring about your planet. This is Tortuga Blanco with a tune called No More from his album Golden Bubble.
Give me a break, and I wanna talk about it. It's too complicated because we allowed it to grow and grow. Now we can't live without it anymore. No, but what would happen if you could not supply? Would you get confused? Would you break down and cry? If you cannot deliver us the river and dry, finally, yeah. The ground is still a long way away, and I wanna keep a flying. But seen it rushing up to today, and I do not feel like dying. Check all the waste, we could go through this maze. What is it that we chase? Is it time that we face? What's really at the base of this complicated case? At this point, yeah. More, 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 and it's possible right now. More, 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 and I don't care how. More, 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 we have made this vow. More, 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 yeah. The ground is still a long way away, and I wanna keep on flying. But I've seen it rushing up to today, and I do not feel like dying. Do you know, no, I cannot believe it, that you think cannot achieve it. Don't you think that we're gonna make it? Do you think that we're gonna take it? Do you know, no, I cannot believe it, that you think that we cannot achieve it. Don't you think that we're gonna make it? Do you think that we're gonna take it? Sure, some proper text and melody come up with why. Would you not be liable? You kill this undeniable. Just take responsibility. Don't doubt the feasibility. You've got the capability to do it, yeah. We are in decline. It's time to redefine, rewrite, reform, and regulate the way we operate. You cannot take what is not yours. Sustainable should be the cost. Recycle and regenerate it. Fundate it. Do you know why? I cannot believe it that you think.
think that we can not achieve it? Don't you think we're gonna make it? Do you think that we're gonna take it? Do you know? No, I cannot believe it. That you think that we can not achieve it? Don't you think we're gonna make it? Do you think that